Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, we want to start things off. Last week, we were talking about the Florida sugar industry and how they had given tens of millions of dollars to Florida lawmakers over the years, more than $57 million to be exact. And we had the question, was that money giving the sugar industry the ability to escape tighter sanctions or higher taxes? Now, I said during the program that we had reached out to both U.S. Sugar and Florida Crystals, and I was wrong, and I apologize. I have to correct myself. We had only reached out to U.S. Sugar, and they had not responded. We did not ask Florida Crystals to join the program. So today, I'm bringing in Mr. Gaston Cantons. He is the vice president of Florida Crystals. Mr. Cantons, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Luis. I appreciate the invitation, the opportunity to participate and to share some of our thoughts with you and your listening audience.
Now, you've heard the anger from some folks who live along the coast on both sides of Florida, from environmentalists, and they're attacking your industry. They say that you have a lot to answer for with this algae bloom, again, due to the large amounts of nutrient-rich water that's coming through the estuaries every time we have to have a release of water from Lake Okeechobee. Well, now you have the chance to answer to the criticism. So what do you say to them?
I understand what their concerns are. I would be frustrated if I were them as well. But their anger and their frustration is misdirected. It's directed at the wrong parties. I mean, you need to understand how, just from a geographic perspective, all of the agricultural areas that we're talking about are south of Lake Okeechobee. And it's not just sugar. I mean, everyone wants to talk about sugar cane and sugar farmers and this and that. The reality is there's 30,000 acres of rice. There's sweet corn. Most of the winter vegetables for the eastern seaboard come out of that region. So you have a very diverse group of farmers doing operating all kinds of farming operations that provide a tremendous amount of food for not just South Florida and Florida, but for the nation. So it's not just sugarcane what's going on. But getting back to the original point is the farms that we're talking about and that they seem to be angry at are south of the lake. The vast majority of the water that goes into the lake, more than 96% of the water, comes in from the north. The headwaters of the Everglades begin up in Central Florida. And all of that water, all of that runoff from Central Florida, Kissimmee, flows down the Kissimmee River. And for too many years, the Kissimmee River has been a pipe, basically, that has, in Central Florida, has used Lake Okeechobee as a toilet. And so you have a lake that has a very high concentration of phosphorus from all of this water coming in from the north. Just to put it in perspective, 2.5 million acre-feet of water have come into the lake this year from the north. 2.5 million acre-feet. That's 2.5 million acres 1 foot deep in water. The releases from the lake have been 1.5 million acre-feet. So it's 1.5 million acres 1 foot deep. That's how much water has been released from the lake, and it's horrible. I don't disagree with them, but we're not the problem. It's not our water. We're not the ones causing this. The water is coming from north of the lake. And for people that say, well, the solution is just buy up all the farms south of the lake and flood them and store the water down there. Well, I mean, that defies logic. If you have all this dirty water coming in from the north, why would you allow it to continue to pollute the lake and then just send it further south? I mean, common sense tells me, don't let it get into the lake. Store it and treat it before it gets into the lake so you have clean water in the lake. And then the whole system benefits from it, not just one portion of it.
I wanted to ask you about one of the other things that we talked about during the program was in a report from the Tampa Bay Times, Mary Ellen Class, talking about the amount of money that the sugar industry had given over the years to Florida lawmakers. Your company, Florida Crystals, had given a little more than $12 million over a couple of decades. That's like any company. That's like any individual giving campaign contributions. Nothing illegal. But at the same time, what exactly did Florida Crystals hope to accomplish by making those kind of contributions?
Well, like you said, it is not unlike any other company that contributes. And you're looking at a time period that is well over two decades. It's unfortunate that Mary Ellen didn't even bother to reach out and get our perspective on it and why it is that we participate in the political process. But if you look at the legislation that has passed over the past 20 years in the state legislature and in Congress, every single piece of legislation has been bipartisan, had almost general consensus of support from all the stakeholders, including environmental groups. If you just look at the different pieces of legislation, I mean, the 2000, you had back, going all the way back to 1994 when you had the original Everglades Forever Act that was passed in 94. In 2003, there were more Everglades bills. 2007, there was a Northern Everglades bill. I mean, you're looking at votes that were even the I'm trying to pull it up right here. 2003 is 144-12 in the Florida legislature. 2007, it was 154-0. 2013, 153-0. So, I mean, these are bills that take a lot of effort and a lot of time to educate members. Term limits creates a greater necessity for educating new legislators because you have a constant turnover. So, I mean, that's really what participating in the political process is. And then you also have the dynamic in our case where you have a family that lost everything because the government took it away from them. And you have individuals in the environmental community who have publicly stated that their goal is to put us out of business, to take our land away. And it's just not something that we can accept.
Let me finish with this. I'm just wondering, you know, as for the residents of Florida, how could they be confident that a company like yours is going to be a good steward of the environment? Because we've seen over the years, especially under this governor, this legislative body, that they have reduced spending on industry oversight. How could you convince residents that they can be confident that companies like yours would be responsible?
Well, I can tell you this. The farmers in Florida, south of Lake Okeechobee, which is known as the Everglades Agriculture Area, are the most regulated farmers in the United States. We are the most taxed farmers in the United States. We have, in addition to our regular property taxes, we pay an additional agricultural privilege tax. It's a tax for the privilege of farming, I suppose, that goes directly to the Water Management District to help pay for projects. So there, we certainly have no, we're not treated any better than farmers around the country. We're actually treated worse. So it certainly, if what the article that was published was trying to insinuate that somehow we have special treatment, we're certainly far from that, because we're more regulated than any other farmers in the country. We're taxed more than any other farmer, not just in the country, but in the state of Florida. And at the end of the day, the results are what they are. The water quality that leaves our basin is better than the water that's in Lake Okeechobee. So over the past 20 years, we have implemented best management practice and stormwater treatment areas that have cleansed the water to the point where the Everglades National Park is today is well below what the goal was. The goal was 10 parts per billion of phosphorus, which is basically 10 drops of water in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. All right. How much phosphorus the goal was for the Everglades.
I need to stop that there only because of time. Gaston Canton's, again, Vice President of Florida Crystals. I really do appreciate your time, and the invitation's always open for you to join us in the future.
Well, thank you, Luis. Look forward to it. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. I also do want to mention, by the way, Mary Ellen Klass is with the Herald Tallahassee Bureau. I misspoke there. All right, I'm going to turn things over and change things up. You've probably heard the name Charles Kinsey now. He's become a national name, national news, international news, actually. He's a North Miami man, a therapist at a group home, who was shot by North Miami police while helping a 23-year-old autistic patient. Now, video of that incident has been seen millions of times, of Kinsey on the ground with his hands in the air. And he says that he was shot in the leg and that he had asked the officer, "Why'd you shoot me?" He says the officer's response was, "I don't know." Yesterday, during a press conference, North Miami Police Chief Gary Eugene didn't say much.
"Breaking in, an outside agency, shows our commitment to transparency and objectivity in a very sensitive matter."
Police Chief Eugene also said the investigation is now in the hands of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Now, they have not released the name of the officer. All we know so far is that it's a 30-year-old Hispanic male who has been on the force for 4 years. Police Union President John Rivera said that the officer involved had meant to shoot the autistic man, not Kinsey.
"He knew or felt that Mr. Kinsey was the victim and was about to lose his life. And rather than to sit there and watch and do nothing, he attempted to stop the white male and accidentally shot Mr. Kinsey."
A Democratic Representative Frederica Wilson was in North Miami angry about what happened.
"We love the police. We know that when the police breaks down, the country is dissolved. There's no, but today, I'm in shock. I what I saw.
Well, there was a crowd of protesters at the police department yesterday seeking answers. Kinsey is recovering, but there are a lot of questions. Well, joining me now in studio, WLRN's own Nadege Green, and from the Miami Herald, David Ovalle. Nadege, David, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. You could tweet us your comments, your questions at WLRN, or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Nadege, you talked with North Miami Mayor Smith Joseph. We heard part of that interview this morning. What else did he say?
He pretty much said that people have to wait for the investigation to be complete, to not jump to any conclusions, because the video does not show the full interaction between the two men and police officers. However, the community, that is not the stance, as we've seen from community members, from advocates, autism advocates, folks in the Black community who just say this was just plain wrong.
I wanted to get the sense, I don't know, because you get the chance to talk to him, really how he's approaching this, because now all of a sudden his police force is now in the national news.
He talked a bit about transparency and there needing to be transparency and being able to communicate well with the public. That hasn't really happened yet, the communication part of it. There was a press conference held. The press was invited. We were told we could not ask questions. The press conference lasted less than 5 minutes with the police chief. And, you know, they didn't give us much information outside of that at all. So I know he wants it to be transparent. He wants there to be good communication and clear communication. But apparently they're still working on that.
David Ovalle, isn't that kind of normal in this situation when there's an investigation? Not a lot is going to get out at the beginning.
Yeah, and I think part of that is they want to make sure that they have all the information before you know, details get out that could shape the way that could compromise the investigation, basically. But, you know, the union did come out, and, you know, the union doesn't always come out to explain police shootings. But in this case, I think they felt the need to clarify the what their version of what happened is. And basically that, you know, that the officer was not aiming at Mr. Kinsey, but at the autistic man who they believed had a weapon, which, you know, I don't think looks any better to the general public. But I think they're sort of trying to tamp down the racial tension that could come along with the shooting of a black man.
When you have a situation like this, though, when you have video that comes out, now the public's going to have its own perception of this incident, but the police have to be careful in how they move forward, right?
I mean, going back to what David just said, and, you know, the messaging that was put out by the PBA, it does not make it better necessarily. You know, okay, we didn't shoot him because he was Black. We were actually shooting at the autistic white guy. You're still getting tension. You're still getting folks in the community who say, wait, time out, guys. You shouldn't have shot at him either. And that's what we heard at the protest yesterday in North Miami. North Miami police spokeswoman came out and doubled down on that and said, look, the healthcare worker was not the intended person that bullet was meant for. And the protesters were like, we would have showed up if it was the white autistic guy who got shot, because that also is not okay, because as we found out, there were no weapons recovered from the scene. So I still think you would see the same kind of outrage. It just necessarily wouldn't be racial.
All right. So, you know, David, we look at this video, and again, it's Kinsey is on the ground. His hands are up. He's talking to this autistic man that he's a caregiver for and trying to talk him into lying on the ground. Police, my understanding in reading your recent article, police may have been far away with assault rifles watching this whole thing going down. This goes to a whole lot of questions. One about how they deal with disabled people, but also, you know, the use of force. Let me start with that one. What's the protocol when they come into a situation? When do assault rifles come out?
Well, in this case, there was a 911 call. This all started with a 911 call, which seems to be a common denominator in a lot of these types of cases where it's sort of the officers are coming in with a different perception of what's really there. So they get the 911 call that there's a man with a gun who looks like he might be suicidal sitting in the street. By the time they get there, the officer who shot was actually about 50 yards away. So it wasn't a close shot. And according to the police union, they could not hear what Mr. Kinsey was saying. So they actually thought that he was in danger, that he was scared for his life. And that's why he was yelling. And at some point, my sources have told me that there's a radio transmission that goes out that says, you know, he's loading his gun, he's loading his gun. So there's something that his movement or something sparks somebody to believe wrongly, as we now know, that a weapon was being loaded. And so then, you know, the officer responds, I have a clear shot, and, you know, the shooting happens. And you know, I guess thankfully he missed.
So do we know if they ever were even within close proximity of Kinsey and this autistic man to figure out what was going on? And if it was an, did they even know it was an autistic man?
No. Well, I mean, if you talk to the police union, they believe that they did not know he was autistic. I mean, obviously, you know, it's interesting. I do not know if those officers have actually been trained in dealing with autistic people. And the irony is that in Miami, there's actually a very, very well-regarded class on crisis intervention that includes a portion of training, could be three and a half hours with the theme of autism and teaching officers how to spot autism and the different scales on the spectrum.
So we don't know if North Miami Police.
Well, North Miami Police sends officers there, but I don't know if these particular officers that were involved had undergone that training.
And also at this point, knowing what we do know about what happened, they didn't even know really who these people were in the middle of the street. There was no communication in order to know exactly like who are you and who are you, because they were far away. We don't know how they were able to see, you know, what was in his hand to be able to say that that was a gun that was being reloaded or it was a toy truck. Like, these are all the questions that have yet to be answered as far as strategy and what the police officers, how they approached the situation and how it ended up with a gunshot, a gun being fired, and ultimately Kinsey being shot.
Do we know, is it confirmed that he really asked the officer, why'd you shoot me? And the response was, I don't know.
That is what he said in an interview with WSBN7, which they initially broke the story, but that was his interview with the station.
So the police department comes out later saying that they meant to shoot the autistic man because they thought he had a weapon and that Kinsey's life was in danger. That's what they're saying right now. And the officer is on administrative leave, which is also typical of the investigation.
Right. And another thing that's an issue here is, you know, oftentimes officers don't realize that someone is autistic, and so they misinterpret. There's always a lot of misinterpretation because, you know, as anyone who's worked in the field will tell you, you know, people with autism often wander away from there, and they often carry objects, and they'll carry like a security blanket type of thing. And in this case, it was a toy. So there's a lot of misinterpretation there. And then what, you know, he wasn't able to verbalize what was going on. He, you know, when they're telling him, get down, he's just sort of yelling and screaming. And that's not unusual for someone who's severely autistic, but it looks like there was a lot of miscommunication that led to, you know, something very, very alarming.
I watched video of some of the protesters who showed up at the police department. A lot of anger, you know, as to why did the officer shoot? Why did they not notice that the young man was, that the other man was autistic? But police, again, not really saying a whole lot, and people weren't happy with that, Nadesh.
No, they weren't happy. And at one point, they actually went into the police station, took the protest inside the North Miami Police Station. And there was back and forth between police officers and protesters speaking with one another or speaking over each other at points. But one of the questions that was repeatedly, like, why did you guys aim to shoot at either of them? Quite a few of the protesters worked for SEIU or were union workers with healthcare workers, and they talked about that. And, you know, they were like, we would have showed up for either men. Like, it would not have been acceptable in either case, but there seemed to be this really distinct push to say this was not about race. It wasn't a black or white thing. And I heard one protester said, well, it was about a right or wrong thing. This is why we're here. And so, you know, that is part of the conversation that's playing out.
You know, we also hear, because shootings that are police-involved shootings, especially the last couple of weeks that have become national news, has raised the question about use of force and police tactics and police training. You know, David, what do we know about those kind of tactics, what the training is for, at least in Miami-Dade, for police? Is it something that they have to revisit, or are they talking about?
Well, I know they're always sort of looking at their policies and use of force policies. And it's definitely something, and, you know, I am in court every day and I speak to a lot of police officers, and it's something they're very cognizant of when they use their weapons, especially now with a lot of the scrutiny that's been going on. It's a really, it's a very tense time to be a police officer in anywhere in the country. And, you know, the interesting thing is that this officer who fired had SWAT training. So it wasn't something that, you know, he had training with an assault style rifle and you know, and he missed. So it's it's something they're definitely cognizant of, and they're always looking at their policies and figuring out what the best options are. But sometimes in these, you know, things can kind of get away from you in these types of adrenaline filled situations.
And I'm wondering too, is there a protocol on evaluating officers' mental health? For PTSDs, things like that, you know, are officers pulled off out of the field if we believe at any point that the stress of the job is taking a toll on them and they need to get out at least for a while?
Well, I know that one of the reasons that they always put officers on administrative leave is specifically to be able to gauge how they're feeling and gauge what is going on, because shooting at someone is a pretty traumatic thing. It's something that, you know, I mean, it's a very stressful job. So, yeah, it's something that they're definitely cognizant of.
I was wondering, Nadezh, after the shooting in St. Paul and then the shooting in Baton Rouge, I'm not talking about the officers who were killed, but I'm talking about the men who were killed by officers. A lot of protests and attention came to those cities. The Black Lives Matter movement came to those cities. What are we anticipating is going to happen in North Miami? This has gone global now.
I mean, I think you're going to see what you've seen in other cities where you have these shootings, and even here where these shootings have happened in other police departments, is groups in the community are going to come together and examine and ask for answers, whether that's in the form of protests. I saw a group of religious leaders after the press conference in North Miami. They had a private meeting with police officers. And so you're going to have community members, as they always do, in situations where there are questions about what's happening in the community, to ask for answers. And that may, you know, appear in different ways, whether it's a protest, whether it's community meetings. The mayor of North Miami said that he was interested in setting up some sort of committee or some sort of hotline for people to call into or to access to talk about how they're feeling and to talk about what is happening, so that his city is able to cope and deal with what's happening as it happens in real time, so that it doesn't bubble up and just fester. So like, these are all the options that could happen in North Miami.
And David, just finally, as we wrap up, is usually these kind of investigations, how long do they take before we find out whether that officer is going to face any kind of charges?
Well, with death cases, it usually takes a lot longer because there's a lot more they have to do. But, you know, that's actually been one of the criticisms, is that sometimes these investigations take a long time. I suspect that this case will get it'll take a few months. But ultimately, the state attorney's office is going to review it, see if there's any, you know, possible charges that could be filed, whether it's an attempted murder, an aggravated battery, something like that. But, you know, it's very hard to charge police officers in use of force cases. It rarely happens in Florida. In fact, hadn't happened for decades and decades until recently in a couple high profile cases outside of Miami-Dade.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle and our own WLRN's own Nadezh Green. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, coming up next, we're going to have the latest news on a new Zika case, actually two of them, and we're going to answer your questions on myths and truths about the virus. That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, yesterday, a second case of locally spread mosquito-borne Zika infection was reported in South Florida, this time in Broward County. State officials investigating a similar case in Miami-Dade. These two cases are being investigated as possibly the first two cases of Zika infections caused by mosquitoes in the United States. And this was predicted a while ago.
One of our colleagues in CDC, maybe 3 weeks ago, he was saying that he expected local transmission to occur here in Florida, probably around mid-July. So we were not surprised that this is what we kind of predicted would eventually happen.
That was Roberto Padilla, a researcher with the University of Florida Entomology and Nematology Department. And You know what? The Florida Department of Health has reported 7 new cases in the state, including 3 pregnant women in undisclosed counties. Again, the total number now over 300. So joining me now in studio, WLRN's Sammy Mack, also from WUSF in Tampa, Julio Ochoa, and from Florida International University's Infectious Diseases Department of Medicine at the Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine, Dr. Eileen Marty. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. If you have questions about Zika, maybe there's something you're not sure about. There have been a lot of stories about it, but hey, maybe you there's something you don't know or you just are not sure of. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Sammy, Department of Health, talking about these 2 new cases in Miami-Dade and Broward County, what do we know?
Well, we don't know a ton yet. What we do know is that they are investigating them as cases that are not people who had a travel history in the places where there are big active outbreaks right now. So that means part of what they're trying to figure out is, okay, then how did they get it? Did they get it from sexual transmission? Did they get it from a mosquito bite? They're doing a lot of interviews of folks right now, and they're also trying to trap mosquitoes and see if there's any virus evident in the mosquitoes around here.
See, that's the thing that I found interesting about this story is, or so they trap mosquitoes. They're trying to figure out, you know, is this coming? Do the mosquitoes now in Florida? In the U.S. now, are they carrying this? Are they spreading this? And this goes off for testing. And I read the story that I guess one of the testing sites is Florida Gulf Coast University, Southwest Florida. And they were talking about, they had said, okay, so these, in this particular case in Miami-Dade, came back negative. Department of Health isn't saying anything, though. They've been kind of quiet.
Right. They have released a couple of press releases in the past few days, but I've had a really hard time getting anybody to call me back with questions, even just about kind of the process. So we've been, as reporters, we've been relying on people who are researchers, who are familiar with these kinds of investigations, to explain sort of the science behind what might be happening. Because part of I think, one of the important things right now for us and for the people who live here is to kind of understand what the process is so that when the science comes out, there's an appreciation of what that means.
And, you know, I'm just wondering, has that been your experience with the Department of Health? Have they been open about the information? Are they telling us everything they can?
It's really hard to tell. I had a conversation. So on Tuesday night at 6:30, we got a press release saying that we had this case that was being investigated. And I called the office immediately, and it was after hours. So then I had to call the after hours phone, which this is a lot of reporter's notebook stuff here. But one of the things that the press release said was that there would be these Zika prevention kits available to neighbors and also for pregnant women for pickup at DOH. So the next morning I went over to one of the main DOH buildings and asked to see one of these kits. And the folks at the front desk had no idea what I was talking about. So I called DOH and was referred to their information office. And they said, well, we can only tell you what's on the press release. And I was like, well, the press release says there's going to be kits. And nobody here knows what I'm talking about. And they're like, well, what does the press release say? And it was like this very sort of back and forth. And I can tell that they're being really cautious right now. And they don't want to scare people. But at the same time,
see, that's an interesting point there. I was talking, you know, cautious, but also how they're informing people. Julio Ochoa, my understanding is you spoke to the Surgeon General, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy today?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, and so just I want to get a sense on a national scale, national level, what Mr. Murthy was talking, saying about this issue, since it's such a prevalent issue here in Florida.
Well, he was concerned primarily with 2 things. One was that people are taking the steps that they need to take to protect themselves. He wants all Floridians to be wearing repellents, stay in AC, air-conditioned places, wear long sleeves, long pants, use windows and door screens, you know, get rid of stagnant water around the home. And secondly, he's very concerned about the funding for the Zika fight, the congressional funding to be specific. He wants to make sure that we are getting the money not only to fight mosquito and have for mosquito control, but also to fund the vaccination science, the study that is going to bring us a vaccination.
I'm wondering, does Mr. Murthy understand that this is Florida? And this is South Florida. Long pants, long sleeves in the summertime.
Yeah, right.
Is that realistic? Is it enough? Is it realistic? Is it enough to say, you know, can we just do with some bug spray?
Yeah, I mean, he said also use repellent if you're going outside. But I know there's mosquitoes all around my house, and they're biting me all the time. So I don't know how you can actually stop getting bit by mosquitoes in South Florida.
Dr. Marty, do we know everything we can know about Zika? I've heard so much information so far.
We're learning more about it every single day. It's a very it was a virus that was just sort of a not very highly regarded for a long time, not realized how serious it can be until the Brazilians pointed out to us the real risk.
You know, something that, and I try not to get scared, but I want to know as much as I can, that now they're looking at possibly a different type of mosquito that could carry the virus, and I'm not even going to try to say its scientific name, but a mosquito that is very prevalent in the United States.
Yeah, Colus quinquefanta, which is the southern household mosquito. It's extremely common mosquito. And what they have found, first they did a few studies a few months ago where showing that Culex could carry it. And more recently, what you read about is that they found wild mosquitoes that were in fact carrying, wild Culex mosquitoes that were carrying it. The next step is to say, okay, so they carry it, can they transmit it? And that has not yet been determined.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. What questions do you have about Zika? Maybe you are a pregnant woman. You got some questions about Zika. 800-743-9576. That's the real scare, really, for a lot of people. First, before we get to that, let me ask you this. If I got the Zika virus as a man, what could I face? What's the danger?
Well, there's an 80% chance, roughly, that you'll get nothing.
I'll show no symptoms.
You'll show no symptoms whatsoever. However, there's still a risk that showing nothing, you might be able to transmit it to your partner. And that individual may, especially if the woman's pregnant or going to get pregnant, then we have that risk of microcephaly. There's a 20% chance that you will have symptoms, and we could go into that.
Sammy Mack, you know what? For pregnant women, we've heard of cases in Latin America. Not so much here yet, right? But isn't this part of one of the investigations so far in these new cases?
Right. So the state surgeon general has said that any pregnant woman who screens positive for Zika or has a risk factor for Zika will be followed for up to a year after birth. And that part of what they're going to be doing is setting them up with some screening. That there's an early steps program that can open up some resources for kids with developmental disabilities. So there is monitoring that will happen well past birth for these folks.
I wanted to get the sense too, because look, a lot of times in the media and especially online, you're going to see stories, you're going to see pictures. So we see these pictures of these babies. That's terrifying. But you know, without causing a lot of fear, what's really the truth here? I mean, what are the percentages, the odds a pregnant woman with this virus is going to have that issue with her child? What should we know, Dr. Marty?
Well, there's been a lot of publications on this, you know, peer-reviewed articles, and the actual exact figures are not certain because different articles have different figures. It can be as much as 27% in some of the articles. But remember, it isn't just microcephaly. It's also other developmental defects which can be relatively minor to relatively severe. And there's also been, here in the United States, death of the fetus in the womb because of Zika.
All right, before I go to the phones real quickly, Julio Ochoa, speaking with the U.S. Surgeon General, curious, did he say anything about the fact that the Rio Games are coming up, a lot of U.S. athletes, U.S. tourists are going to be in Brazil?
You know, he didn't say especially about the Games, but he did say if you are traveling to another area that you think is going to have Zika and you're returning home, you have to be careful. You have to get checked out by a doctor. And he said, you know, if you have a partner who is pregnant, then you should withstand from having sex for the duration of the pregnancy.
All right, let me go to the phones. I want to start with Yivica, I believe, in Fort Lauderdale. Yivica, welcome to the program.
Hello.
What's your question?
Yes. I'm a young professional in Fort Lauderdale, and I'm in the category of people not planning to have kids or not currently pregnant. And I was just wondering, what do we need to know about Zika? And are there any conclusive studies on long-term effects? Like if we have it in our system and it leaves our bodies without leaving a trace, like what do we know so far about what it could do later on?
Long-term effects. All right, Yivica, thank you so much for the call. Long-term effects.
Well, what we now know and what we believe is going on is that most people who have symptoms recover and have lifelong immunity. That's what we think happens, but we're not 100% sure that it is lifelong immunity. Among those small percentage of people who get something such as Guillain-Barré syndrome, they, with our technology and our medical care, they can recover. However, there is a possibility of long-term consequences from the Guillain-Barré.
And what is Guillain-Barré?
Guillain-Barré is an autoimmune syndrome that affects the nervous system and causes paralysis. And it has been responsible for the death of some individuals, adult individuals with Zika, if they are not placed in an ICU right away where they can, where breathing can be done for them.
But something you said too. So we have now over 300 cases confirmed in Florida. But as you said, many people who get it aren't going to show symptoms. So what's the real number? What do you think is the real number?
Well, I think we're going to have to do the surveillance to find out what that real number is. And right now it's very difficult to do that because we have a limited amount of testing capability. And the focus is on testing individuals that are either pregnant and or symptomatic.
And yeah. Sammy, just to finish up, you know, so we're waiting to see what Congress is going to be giving, you know, when it comes to funding and helping states fight Zika. So Florida,
which will be another month and a half, two months.
Another month and a half, 2 months
at the very least.
And so, you know, the state is putting in its money. The counties, I mean, really, how much of this is on just the local communities? How much are they depending on us as Floridians to be a little more careful? We're kind of used
heavily
to mosquitoes. We're used, and we travel a lot.
Yeah, they're relying on us very, very heavily, and if you'll see every communication that comes with anything about Zika from the health department, you will see there are steps with it to drain, to wear your long sleeves, to wear your repellent, and they're leaning really heavily on civilians to do what they can. That said, without that money from Congress, there's stuff that you and I, Lewis, like, we can't control mosquitoes for an entire county, and that stuff takes money. We can't test for it. That takes money. We can't do the surveillance and the interviews and the epidemiology ourselves, and that takes resources. So that's the part that, you know, people in public health from the, you know, county level on up to the federal level who work in this stuff are really worried about. And I just wanted to add, I did get word that there are going to be Zika prevention kits prioritized for pregnant women that may be available from the health departments. However, you should call ahead. They will take your name, and I was told they'd get back to you within 24 hours. I still haven't heard back, but they've got another hour. I called at 1:15 yesterday. And give those folks some answers about where and when they can pick that up.
And so we got some answers today, but again, if you have questions, you can always find us online and share your questions, and maybe we can find those answers for you. Again, we've been talking with WLRN's Sammy Mack, also Julio Ochoa from WUSF in Tampa, and from Florida International University's Infectious Diseases Department, Dr. Eileen Marty. Thank you so much, everybody. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, coming up next, you know, it was a year ago when we opened up diplomatic ties with Cuba. It was official a year ago. So what's changed in that time? We'll talk about that coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. So it was July 20th of 2015 when the Cuban flag joined the flags of other nations here in the United States that the U.S. has diplomatic relations with. A month later, the U.S. Embassy opened up in Havana. President Barack Obama spoke about the changing of the times between the two nations.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba in the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years. We will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
But what's really changed? I mean, there are cruise ships that can now go to Cuba, soon airliners, scientists are sharing work, more people can travel back and forth, but really, what's changed? And more Cuban migrants are now trying to make it to the U.S. in that treacherous journey they take by boat or raft. I mean, this past week, more than 60 migrants made it to the U.S. shores. You know, the U.S. made a lot of effort to rebuild ties between the two countries, but has Cuba made the same effort? What's changed? We want to hear your thoughts online at WLRN on Twitter, or find us on Facebook, thefacebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Joining me now is Mimi Whitefield of the Miami Herald, joining us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral, and Michael Weisenstein is at the Associated Press Savannah Bureau, joining us also online. I appreciate both of you coming on today. Mimi, let me start with you. I mean, a year later, most of the effort to normalize relations really seems like it's been on the U.S. side, but what has Cuba done?
Well, Cuba hasn't done that much, and what it says is basically we didn't have an embargo against the United States. We didn't have these economic sanctions. So, of course, the United States would have to do a bit more. And, of course, we still do have the embargo. But I think most of the disappointment on the U.S. side is there were a number of business opportunities and regulations changes that were outlined by the U.S. administration. And Cuba really hasn't taken them up on very many of these things.
I mean, your overall take on this past year, is there any one thing that jumps out at you?
I think that the most visible thing is with the change in regulations on travel, the number of Americans that you will see in Cuba these days, and the variety of Americans that are now traveling. And that does, to a certain extent, have a trickle-down aspect. There are a lot of private restaurants, people renting rooms in their homes. So in that sense, the Cuban people are benefiting. But that's kind of been the complaint. Okay, the relationship has changed, but how has it changed the lives of the Cuban people?
Yeah, Michael Weisenstein, you're there. You got the Cuban, the viewpoint from Cuba. But what has this past year been like there in Havana?
I think the biggest change looking out from Cuba has been what you mentioned in the introduction, the flood of people leaving. I think, unfortunately, in the short term, the biggest effect has been to create a panic among Cubans that the special immigration privileges are going to end sometime soon, and it is best to get to the United States and establish legal residency if you're able to. And very tragically, that for a lot of people means either dangerous treks through South and Central America and Mexico, or even worse, getting on rafts to Florida, where a lot of people are suffering, and or on the way to which a lot of people are suffering and drowning. And that's really the unfortunate side effect of all this.
You're talking about Cuban migrants trying to make that trek, that waterway trek to the U.S., to take advantage of the wet foot, dry foot policy. One of the things since last October, the report from the U.S. Coast Guard is that more than 5,200 Cuban migrants have attempted that journey, and that's up from the 4,400 plus the year before. But Michael, I mean, is there a fear that because of these new relations, all of those things are going to go away and that journey won't be worth taking anymore?
There's a fear that the dry, wet foot, dry foot will go away, and all the immigration privileges that surround that policy, and that if you're Cuban and you have a chance of getting to the States, you should go now, because who knows? And, you know, a country with normal relations does not have special immigration privileges. There's absolutely a sense in Cuba that it's go now or you might not be able to.
Mimi Whitefield, is there a lot of talk here about getting rid of it?
It's actually not a very popular policy in South Florida anymore. Some members of the Cuban-American delegation in Congress are opposed to wet foot, dry foot. Basically, they say what it does is encourage these dangerous voyages by sea. We've seen some rather unfortunate incidents where some of the potential arrivals have become quite belligerent with authorities because they were, you know, hell-bent on reaching the beach.
We have heard also from Senator Marco Rubio that he's still against having an ambassador, a U.S. ambassador, in Havana. Probably not a lot's going to happen until after the election, but he holds that ground. Is that a popular position right now? Mimi Whitefield, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure how popular it is. The chargé d'affaires at the embassy is essentially acting as the ambassador. I'm not sure that people in the South Florida community are as adamant that there should not be an ambassador as Marco Rubio.
And, you know, we're coming up on this election in just a few months, but is there any concern, and I want to ask both of you this, Mimi, I'll start with you, that, well, depending on who ends up in the White House, how is that going to impact these relations?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton certainly would continue pretty much intact the policy of the Obama administration. Donald Trump has said that he wants a better deal, and you know, that's open to interpretation. Would he roll back some of these things in his quest to get the better deal? Would be the question.
And Michael, how do Cubans see this election, and are they rooting for somebody in particular?
I think among the Cuban government, they make a vary in their public statements or their private conversations with U.S. and foreign reporters here. They make a conscientious effort to not appear concerned by the election. I think there is a sense of growing urgency in Cuba that's not necessarily driven by the presidential election entirely, but by the fact that Venezuelan aid here has dropped sharply, and we're really starting to see the effects. Cuba, more broadly than just in the sense of U.S. politics, I think is worried about the future.
And Michael, coming back again to everything that we've seen over the past year, again, we've seen now cruise liners docking in Cuba, bringing Americans, more Americans now to Cuba for cultural exchanges. Airliners soon, some airliners will be able to fly into different cities. You know, do Cubans feel an impact? U.S. dollars coming in, travelers coming in, do they feel an impact that's positive?
I think those Cubans who are lucky, and it's a real divide here, those Cubans who are lucky enough to be plugged into the tourist economy, many of whom are plugged in because they have access to dollars from abroad, many of which are coming from South Florida, they feel a difference. There is a sharp uptick in tourists. That's a lot more money coming in here. And I think the real explosion will be when U.S. Commercial flights start, because if those truly run full and run at the number that the U.S. government is allowing, that's going to be potentially millions more Americans coming each year, and that will really have a big macroeconomic effect.
All right, Mimi Whitefield, in just under 60 seconds here, you know, we come back, critics of this still say, look, Cuba hasn't done enough with its human rights issues, and they're still imprisoning dissidents. Do you see that changing anytime soon with these open relations?
Well, they continue to talk. They said they're going to schedule another meeting on human rights. But one of the problems is the Cubans say they have a different concept of human rights than the United States, that rather than, you know, sort of basic civil rights that we cherish in the United States, they say sort of social programs, health care, are more important. And there is this divide. So that will be a tough nut to crack.
All right. Mimi Whitefield again of the Miami Herald joining us from the WLRN studios in Doral. Also, Michael Weisenstein at the Associated Press Havana Bureau. I would thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, and that's going to do it for the Florida Roundup, and we want you to join our new Facebook group. Post your comments about today's show. Tell us, what are you talking about? Facebook.com/groups/ The Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our technical supervisor, Jason Zapka. Thank you, Jason. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.